So this is our B2B CX roundtable. It's held about every 4 to 7 weeks. If anybody knows a speaker or wants to speak, get in touch with me. I am Chief CX Analyst at Interaction Metrics. We are a customer feedback company. We also do customer service evaluations. I've been hosting the B2B roundtable for about 4 years with CXPA. And my company, Interaction Metrics, has been in business. This is our 21st year, so we've been doing this a long time. I always like to, for the B2B roundtable, get us kind of level set on what is the difference between B2B and consumer CX. And basically, I've over the years created a list of five differences. And one is large spend. B2B customers simply spend more. There are multiple decision makers involved. Probably most interesting and different of all, it really is a true partnership in that there's an ongoing dialogue between customers and companies that really affects both parties. There are multiple touch points with B2B CX, so tech support, field service, engineering, outside sales. And then there are very high expectations. So B2B customers are accustomed to those sleek experiences that Apple provides. And so they're spending a lot, so they really, everything sort of ratcheted up. So that's how in 30 seconds I describe the difference between B2B and consumer CX. Those of you who are not with CXPA or members of CXPA, you may want to consider it. It was founded in 2011, and they really are the premier global organization dedicated to CX. And they do certification in CX. It's called CCXP, and I'm certified. And it's just kind of a fun thing to get certified in customer experience. And today's topic is how to use AI for B2B research. I'm super excited to do this with you guys because we've got three excellent, consummate panelists. They are Matt, Jillian, and Jack. And they're going to start by talking, kind of providing their bona fides with regard to this topic in just a couple of sentences. Let's start with you, Matt, then Jillian, and then Jack.
Hey, everybody. It's good to see some folks again and some new folks. I'm the founder and CEO of JourneySpark Consulting. I launched my own firm a few years ago. I used to lead the CX practice at PwC. I worked across a range of industries, both B2B and B2C. And my specialty is how CX and culture go together. And I have a book and a podcast, both called The CX and Culture Connection.
Okay.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Jillian Salerno-Rebick. I am out of Austin, Texas. I wear a couple different hats in my professional life. I am the strategic marketing lead at Wevo as well as a board advisor. Wevo is an AI and customer insight platform that blends both human insight and feedback with AI simulated feedback. I own my own small consultancy that is in the UX space, working on digital and sometimes physical product, creating new experiences that delight customers. And I also teach at the University of Texas at Austin, teaching design thinking.
And Jack?
Hi, I'm Jack Morgan Mazzell. I am also in Austin, Texas. I spent several years working with big tech on a lot of B2B and consumer side AI products, as well as, work processes within those AI products. And currently, I'm working as a senior behavioral scientist for a smaller organization that is trying to develop new voter engagement tactics. So, a bit of a flip of the hat there. Yeah, that's me.
Cool. All right. So let's start with sort of a level set because I'm not sure everybody knows what research is and why it's used. And any of you can jump in with your thoughts about what is research?
Can I give it a
Go for it, Jack.
So I think if I had to describe it really, really tersely, it's the disciplined practice of gathering, analyzing and then interpreting data, broadly skewed. So that's the really big picture answer.
And what would, but what kind of data?
So that's the thing. It could mean anything. It could be interviews, watching someone, how they interact with your app, down to actually sort of the user funnel, like what gets people to click to conversion, for sales funnels and things like that. So it's really, really broad, going from anthropology down to hard data science.
Okay.
Building on the broad theme, you know, I think a lot of historically research was used up front in designing things. So if we think about like the experience space, there's like new products, new websites, new apps, you know, new packaging, new something. And that could be a physical thing, or it could be a digital thing, or something that's digital, that's both. And a lot of times research is used to inform bigger decisions where their intuition and lack of data, you want to go get data and inform the decision for some larger investment. A lot of time research was used earlier in the decision cycle. And now what we're seeing is it's more throughout the cycle. And there's an opportunity to do testing and experimentation and analytics where you're leveraging data. And to Jack's point, you're seeing this blending of more bespoke research methodologies that are highly scientific and high, you know, with things that are much more agile. And the question is, are they valid? You know, are they actually, is there enough science behind them just because there's a tech platform there?
So drilling into B2B research, let's talk about examples, concrete examples of how research and the research mindset is used in B2B.
Yeah, I can start with that. I think, you know, thinking about it's a focus on more complex journey, higher stakes, multi-person buying decisions, kind of like how you were introducing the space earlier, Martha. And I think when I think about what it looks like, it's kind of what questions are we trying to answer?
Oh, hey, you guys, you might want to have your mics on mute. Okay, you keep going.
And then the key questions that we're going to be answering in B2B research are things like, do customers understand our value proposition? Or what friction is slowing down our lead to close journey? What messaging is going to resonate most with our targeted personas? Or how does our digital experience compare to competitors? Or something as simple as, you know, where are we losing deals and why?
Right. So,
I think
it's certainly beyond, because sometimes when I bring up the topic of research, people jump into, oh, it's that customer satisfaction questionnaire, and that's like 1% of it, right? Mm-hmm, like it's so much broader.
Yeah, a lot of layered insights, and it's a whole ecosystem of stakeholders that you're dealing with.
Right.
But that's a really good point, though, Martha, because like it's part of the equation, right? Like you do have these insights, and as we get more and more data signals, like it's not just a survey, but we're analyzing unstructured data with AI, there's this, how do you decide when and how research is needed? And is it enough to validate other insights? When do you want to go deeper? How do you stretch and use your budget best, given the volume of data signals that are out there that are complements to more bespoke research?
Right. And who's the person, or what's the team in the organization that should take on research? Or should it always be commissioned, as probably Jack and I would think, by an outsider as a way to eliminate bias and subjectivity? But what are your thoughts on that, Matt and Jillian and Jack? I certainly don't mean to speak for you.
I think it's both.
I think.
Go ahead, Jillian.
Go ahead, Matt. Okay. I was about to say both as well. And I think that probably it should come from product teams inside, maybe even marketing teams inside. You know the product best, you know your kind of end user groups the best, but that you sometimes do need that outside perspective to layer in process and protocol that may just kind of have fallen by the wayside within the team. I think that ultimately, you're trying to improve experiences at every touch point, and that it's not necessarily just your end user, but it's also what's going on with field teams, what's going on in the sales cycle, and how rebuilding trust all the way through.
One of my favorite sayings, like I think is relevant to this, is a company, W.L. Gore, has this phrase, is it above the waterline? Right. So if the decision is above the waterline, it means you're not going to sink the ship if you make a mistake. Okay. And it's okay to have more, like, you know, learning with more, things that could go wrong if it's a reversible decision, if it's above the waterline. And a lot of people talk about like democratized insights or empowered culture where more people can act on data faster. And like, if it's above the waterline, that's a really good thing. Now, if it's a really expensive decision or not reversible decision or big change in direction, you're going to have more executive decisions weighing in on that. So I think it's a bit of both, and you just got to recognize, you know, what type of decision it is and have a culture that actually, based on the informal versus the formal, and a culture, the informal often wins over formal. But you want to have a culture where people aren't making irresponsible decisions. It's not the culture is like you make decisions when they're above the waterline, not when they're below the waterline.
Yeah. And I just want to jump off of both of your points and sort of even to Martha's there, having sort of an outsider who can kind of come in and maybe doesn't have a vested interest in whether the decision goes one way or the other is really practical for those high risk decisions, because what they bring to the table is, one, like you said, Julian, a new perspective, but two, they have the expertise and sort of the rigor and training behind them usually to actually make sure those decisions are being made and the information being collected to make those decisions is done in a very like disciplined fashion, just to improve that certainty.
Right, there's true methodological expertise. I always say, you know, anybody can own Photoshop, but it doesn't make them a graphic designer. And just because you have these tools doesn't suddenly make you a research scientist. Okay, so let's now jump into the topic at hand. So we've kind of laid out all of this splatter about research and what it is. But what's happened in this past year with regard to AI and what it's doing to expedite research?
Yeah, I think, massive, massive shifts. I think like we've moved from early adoption to mainstream adoption now. Some people are still hesitant, I think, with how do I use it, where and when do I use it, and what does it actually look like in an effective way. I think about kind of three different things: speed and structure. Using AI to understand early and often, kind of within a predefined, informed framework. You're letting kind of speed, not letting speed come at the cost of validity when you're kind of using AI to move your strategies forward. Also think about, when we're talking about AI and like pulling it into experimentation, pulling it into research, you want to make sure that you're enabling your team to work effectively and have guardrails. There should be training on these tools of how to use them most effectively, without needing a PhD in research. Can you give guidelines and training and oversight to pull AI into your workflow that makes it work, makes you work smarter and not harder?
Yeah. This roundtable, maybe yank it back a little bit and just talk about, are you using AI to write the questions? Are you using AI to record the focus groups, insights? Are you using AI to actually conduct the interviews? Like, talk very specifically about how AI as a researcher or a research partner is different than the humans.
Because Yeah, absolutely. And I think the answer is all of it and more, including using AI to give answers sometimes as well. Weevo is a platform that Weevo Pulse can simulate audience feedback with 80% accuracy within 5 minutes. You can tune your personas to answer questions about your platform, to understand and kind of get a gut check on what's going on. It is a tool in our tool belt that we say complements our Wevo Pro offering that is with real human feedback. But we've trained our AI on the million plus user studies we've done previously. So you're getting simulated feedback to kind of gut check where you're at. But additionally, yeah, I'd say like AI interview platforms are also exceptionally interesting because it does kind of cut down on your cycle time of getting that feedback because someone can do the interview for you or the AI can do the interview for you. I've also seen a lot of platforms that really do a great job at synthesizing big thematic insights that are coming out of these interviews as well. Our AI note takers as well, doing the most for us these days. It really can be infused everywhere. And I do think to keep in mind that it is a tool in the tool belt. It's not the magical fix-all pill that's going to eliminate that work for you. It is something that if you have the process, the protocol, the rigor, or someone on your team does, that's kind of who should be in the driver's seat of it. And then there are guide rails, guidelines, training and oversight that can happen to make it be an efficient and whip smart go-to tool for y'all.
Yeah.
Okay. Wevo, but let's talk about the tools that everybody in this roundtable mm-hmm. would be familiar with, like Gemini, yeah. like Claude, yeah. Like Chat GPT. How can those tools be leveraged for AI?
Yeah, so I can speak to my own experience and sort of like how I step my toes into actually using AI for research, not like necessarily researching the AI itself. Where I jumped in there was sort of solving the blank page problem. Like, let's say you suddenly get told, hey, we need a survey on this topic. And you, because you are an outside person, you're brought in, you've never heard of this topic. So guess what? You can learn really, really quick with AI, sort of like what the major topics are, things like that, through talking with stakeholders and everything, and draft up sort of a first draft of a survey. But where I've had a lot of issues is taking that as like, okay, this is the final product, or even this is the full first draft. Like anything that I've seen produced by AI, I want to make changes to, additions, alterations, and that's gone from like things like grammar to things more like around how, you know, I design things, and also just like aspects that can't understand just human context and aspects like that. So I'm sort of talking about like using it just for like making maybe the early part of a research process easier, but I've also used it in quantitative analysis in a similar fashion where, okay, I don't want to build this whole script in R or Python to analyze this data set and build out these graphs. Like that's a, you know, hours of work to get that done. But I can get a first draft of it that probably will have an error or two and have some issues. But because I have the sort of that expertise in this, I can then adapt and change it to make sure it's like real. So it's like it's been a good speed tool that then requires me to iterate on it.
What I found is there's a drop-off point, especially with ChatGPT, and we have the most advanced model. But if you keep at some point you keep probing, and it gets better and better, and then it starts diminishing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and that's when I know. Okay, send in the humans.
Yeah, I think Martha, we're hitting on a. I think it's a really good question about where you use it in your day-to-day workflow. I think there's two fundamentally different things we could talk about here. One is, and they're both valuable. One is, how does AI enable you to be more efficient and effective at things you already do so that we can effectively do them with less time, with more confidence, with higher quality, with less budget. And then for the same budget, you can do more research for your budget because you have more time available of your expert people, as well as the stakeholders they engage with. So things like summarizing meetings or doing research are all great examples of improving the workflow, but you never want to take the human out of the loop for all the reasons Jack is mentioning. And we could spend the whole discussion on avoiding bias, right? And avoiding hallucinations. So Let's be responsible, and we can agree on that, and we won't spend the whole hour talking about that. Although let's make sure we do talk about it. The second category is that we do things that we might otherwise not have done before. Mm-hmm. Or, and I like to frame this in this context of bringing the customer into the room throughout the entire design and build and iteration process. And it's expensive and time consuming to bring the customer into the room. Now, as customer experience professionals, we want to do that. And we look to researchers to do this in the right way, whether that's a persona or a journey. I see we've got, you know, Dave on the call, others that, you know, do this. You know, that's really important to do that the right way. Or like you say, design the survey very intentionally with the right expertise, like so you get the right insights up front and you get the right insights on the back. Now, you can also start leveraging AI now to ideate, to ask questions. So you can bring that proverbial persona into the room and you can start testing things that are very low fidelity, that are concepts, that are texts, that are low fidelity wires, that are mock-ups. You can do rapid prototyping. Today, there's a lot of money that gets sunk into research as well as the development spend, and then you go do A-B split testing, and you actually are very far over your skis before you get feedback. And we haven't brought the customer into the room all the way at every step along the journey. So like Jillian talked about doing, getting results in 5 minutes instead of 5 days. It used to take 5 weeks. Now it's like, you know, 5 days is too slow. Now we want it in 5 minutes. Well, guess what? We need all of the above. We're not going to get rid of the 5 week research or the 5 day research, but now we can get the 5 minute throughout the entire journey and then validate and go further with the other method. So it's not that the other stuff goes away. It's that the discovery and the customer in the room is there more often as a companion to the human.
Yeah. So quite bluntly, it's about expediting all the current ways we do research, but it's also offers the opportunity to do to do new kinds of research that we didn't do heretofore. Yeah. I think it a little bit brings up, and I know it's going to come up when we open this up, quant versus qual research. So do you guys just want to each of you do a kind of a quick take on quant versus qual research and where AI is more or less useful on either of those?
I can start. Yeah, so I spent a lot of my time in the qualitative space with some quantitative validation, but mostly in the sticky, gooey center of qualitative research. And I think the limitations for AI are when you're talking about very human things that are hard for an AI to ground itself in empathy with. Things in the medical space, things in the potentially like family and children space, that might be where AI has the biggest shortcoming and should be handled appropriately. But I think overall, like AI hasn't really changed the definition of what a quality insight can look like. It really has just changed the pace and accessibility of getting there. And that a quality insight still means it's timely, it's trustworthy, it's tied to a real decision, it's understandable by non-researchers, and it's backed with human empathy and data at scale. So that's kind of where I find it in the qual space, and I'll let Jack Morgan take the quant space for sure.
Yeah, so I end up doing a lot of both, although quant is my home. So with quant, I find it very good on the, so like what I was mentioning, on the analysis end, like being able to code up an analysis and perform those kind of things with it. Although I will say, if you just literally ask it to analyze a data set, it will quite often hallucinate in my experience and sort of break down.
Because it wants to give you an answer. That's something that I learned relatively recently. Like it will always give you an answer.
Yes. It will not tell you, no, I don't understand this. I've also had it tell me different things like, oh yeah, you can download this data set here. It doesn't exist. So it's fully hallucinating a result. But on the qualitative end, now that's where I found it. I have reservations from my own experience doing this for things. where I've had either open text responses to surveys or interviews and different things, and tried to do thematic analysis using AI, where you know, connect the dots, the GUI center, try to like identify insights and overveiling themes. And when I've asked it to do this multiple times, I've also seen several people post about this and report on it. It will identify a different number of themes. Different themes will have different levels of prevalence, different things there that make me feel like it's risky to just completely rely on it for that sort of like, you know, level of analysis rather than you going through each item. And maybe there is sort of like a middle ground where you use it to guide you and maybe identify some themes, but you still have to do some manual labor to really trust those insights, in my opinion.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I do the kind of like bite sizing. If you ask AI more than 1.5 questions, it's going to give you a muddy answer at best. And I think that, again, I'm going to continue to say, like, it is the tool to help you work faster when you know how to ask the right questions. And when you can bite size things for it, you can get to like the nugget of truth much quicker.
I'd love to illustrate a real example to bring this in and contrast some things. Like, let's say a B2B company that I worked with on creating a digital trade show, right? Because it's in this company, it's a toy company who sells to hundreds of thousands of small toy retailers around the world. So while it's CPG and retail, it's actually B2B. Because they're selling to hundreds of thousands of retailers and looking at how do we optimize the experience for what toys to carry, how to talk about them in the store, how to merchandise them, how to drive. You know, the difference between a good retail and a bad is 10x the sales per square foot. So like getting this right has a huge impact. All right. So the problem is 80% of their customers don't go to a toy fair in different places around the world. So they need to bring the toy fair to the customer through a digital trade show. Now, in the past, like if you're designing this, the best practice would be to both commission original research, you know, and then you're going to get upfront insights. You're going to send your designers on ride-alongs and customer interviews. So in addition to having expert research, you'll have your designers and UX, UI people directly involved in the interviews, getting their fingernails dirty. And then when you have prototypes, you're going to get user testing and feedback. That all should continue. Because you're not going to get the same depth of insights from the AI as you are from either the research that's well designed or the experts conducting these interviews themselves with real customers. Or Yogi Berra says you observe a lot by watching, right? You like ethnography still rules, right? So now what's different now? It's an and again, okay? You can take different levels of the fidelity of this prototype and run it through tools like Weibo. So in the past, you would have a video recording of a user test. Now they've taken millions of user tests and run it through the AI that can simulate how particular personas will react to the same thing that you would give real people a test. And it gives you a very powerful exploratory insights that you can then complement through actual in-depth interviews and other approaches to validate and go deeper. So just like you use AI to get primed quickly and then you go do it, informs your research plan. Why wouldn't you take the 5 minutes to do this and get in what you, and from a culture standpoint, what you want is hundreds of people doing this and it changes the way they work together.
Right. Now I think
rather than like a few people do it.
So in other words, it's simulated research is a fantastically new, I don't mean fantastic in a, I mean, in a sort of like out there sort of sense, not a, I'm endorsing it or not endorsing it, but just, it's a whole different research tool to think about simulated research, right?
It doesn't take away from the need to do the other stuff.
Right.
But it's actually fairly inexpensive to add it to your repertoire. And what I typically find is that like at one bank client, they were able to stop 30% of the research they would otherwise have done and redeploy that budget for other things that was more valuable. They don't cut their budget. They use it better.
Right, right.
Yes.
I think I have a whole bunch of more questions for you guys about replicability and growth mindset and culture, but let's open it up to the group And maybe we'll bring it back, but I'm wondering if some of those who are in the group, like Dave Seaton, you might have some questions about or some reflections on AI as it pertains to journey maps, for instance. But I just see so many people in the group who I think might have some very directed kinds of questions or insights that they want to add here.
Sure, happy to jump in, Martha. We do heavy qualitative research in the form of customer interviews as we're creating our journey maps. And I have 100% replaced human transcription with AI transcription. So I'm no longer paying people in other countries to have the little foot pedal and listen to the interview and type in the transcription. AI does all of that very quickly and with very high quality, and my team can edit any of those transcripts as necessary. What I am currently experimenting with is taking those transcriptions. Now we do the analysis with humans. So we go through the interviews, we have our code book, we tag and we analyze and we discuss and everything. I'm now experimenting with uploading those transcripts into a Copilot, for example, and because of security and privacy and all that, and having the Copilot do some interpretation, identify themes. And we're using that as a check on our own bias as researchers, because, you know, if you're 25 interviews in to a 30 interview product, your brain's already started drawing some conclusions, even if you try not to.
Sure.
And so we're using the Copilot as like a check on, you know, did our own bias interpret how we analyze these interviews? Is there something gaping that we're missing? But I would love to hear from the panel how I can accelerate that analysis of these qualitative interviews.
Take a stab. Yeah, I think Dave, that's super smart, that you're containing it in an environment. I think that self-contained environment, like a notebook LM or a Copilot, makes the most sense because then you're reducing the opportunity for hallucination. And I think, I wonder what it looks like to give it your maybe your kind of way of analysis and analyzing, if you can show it your process, kind of teach it your process and see if it runs through your process the same way you do, or if it has other questions. Obviously, I think we're not at the point where AI is really asking us thoughtful questions back, but I'm looking forward to that day. But I do think you set yourself up a good structure so far. And I think the thing that I've found is going question by question and then section by section is kind of the best way to understand exactly what it's seeing, so that you're not getting to a place where you're having misinterpreted data by the AI. The last thing I would say is I always am coaching AIs. If I'm using them to do analysis or create a first draft of something for me, I give them their persona. I tell them what they are and who they are to me and who they are to the company, and why their role is important, and what I expect from them as a senior executive or whatever that is, so that mindset comes through as well.
You know, Dave, you got me thinking about like how when you take a hypothesis-driven approach, how do you make sure you don't lock too soon on like confirming the hypothesis versus being willing to reject the hypothesis? Or, you know, when do you close off your thinking? And, you know, what a lot of times we'll do, you know, in at Journey Spark, when we create like personas and journeys, is like we'll try to create a set of attributes around the persona that I mean, I think you do a more in-depth approach on the journey. So I'm talking more about the personas here rather than the journey itself, with which I think your Dharma method is awesome. Okay. And the so if we're building a journey, a persona, what I find is really valuable is to connect that to the drivers of customer lifetime value. So it is a qualitative exercise. It's you're getting into the emotions and the mission and the purpose and the behaviors. But what is it that about this persona that makes one of them more valuable than another from a design target standpoint? And usually there's some revenue potential versus cost to serve dimensions, and you can like, and what we're often looking for when we're scoring the interviews and like diving into these qualitative interviews is to pick the right attributes and the right way to score them. And we have human beings using judgment to say, is this person's leadership potential, is it a 10 or a 2? Based on, and what are the notes from the interview that lead me to believe this is higher on this or lower on that? Well, first thing we can do with AI, which we do, is ask, do we have the right attributes? Did we actually pick the right attributes and get the human being, I love your co-pilot, to say, did we pick the right ones? And it's a collaborator and a check on, did we lock too soon on the right attributes? And then we get it to score the interviews. And one travel client, as an example, we did 30 in-depth interviews to kind of validate and try to come up with the right attributes. But then we had the AI score 10 6,000 customers over lots and lots of unstructured data records, which were emails and calls. And we took it out of Snowflake and Azure, and we had ChatGPT in a safe environment actually analyzing all of this to figure out, could we get the right attributes? And then we went back and validated it with salespeople. So it was highly iterative. After that whole process, we got the organization to buy into the personas, to buy into the right attributes. And now we can actually score all their customers once they have a minimum volume of conversations, which allows us to tailor the advertising and the lookalike analysis and the website. And we ran an ad campaign in Facebook, which had a 50% higher marketing ROI than dynamic content optimization, because we optimized the content for the ad campaign through the eyes of the persona using Weibo.
So,
Right?
hey, Matt, let me interrupt you. It actually, what you're saying is that you, in this particular case, were using AI facilitated research to, in a sense, change the whole culture, right? Like
Yes,
it
we
or
wanted to. That's right, Martha. We explicitly talked about how do we build a culture of experimentation, and also how do we build a culture of collaboration where people are collaborating between marketing, product development, the tech, the sales, the operations, and using the personas and the journeys as a launching off point to get people aligned around the right opportunities. But we're using the AI throughout the process to get better insights and enable iterative approach. Like Dave was mentioning, as a co-pilot method, where the human beings are always not only in the loop driving the decisions. And in some cases, we were like, this is not ready. We need to train the model. It's only 50% accurate. We got to get better, right? And you got to know how is it working or is it not working? And don't make decisions on 50% accurate data.
Busy.
Right. Who let's make sure we're addressing all the needs of the roundtable here. Who else has a question? They can just shout it out or put it into the chat. A question or a reflection on how your company is using AI or is holding back on using AI. I think that's also interesting.
Yeah, I think that's interesting as well. Mine in particular is holding back. Me personally, I'm doing all I can to upscale. So it's very interesting to watch how things are unfolding. When everything around me says that there's a move to there's this urgency for change and to, get on that path that few are going down for some odd reason. So I'm just glad to hear you guys sharing. Thank you.
One of the B2B guys, we work in the automation space, robotics, motion, inverters, factories, oil fields, everything you can think of. And we're using AI, have been using AI in a very limited basis, on a machine learning, and of course, CAD/CAM. And listening to how we're talking about, using AI in this scenario is just fascinating to me, because in a machine, I'm looking at a robot in an application and deciding, okay, what works, what doesn't, and thinking about, and Martha, you know best, we have one customer that has 50 touch points. I could be listening to all 50 of them. 30 of them are screaming that something's not right, and yet the five who are the most important were doing exactly what they want. And it's like, how do you make sure you're filtering out and responding? Obviously you could say, well, we won't listen to those, but somewhere those 30 could pile up and become a major problem. So it is interesting to hear all of this. I'm just curious, how will it be relevant in these large B2B models that, yes, everyone has a voice and yes, we want to take care of them, but not all of them have the same, weighting as some of those voices.
Jack, do you want to reflect on that a little bit?
Yeah, I can talk about this a little broadly. I think it's a risk. Like, I think it's really a risk with these AI generated insights, in that they can really sort of like empower decision makers by having sort of like this plug and play instant answer. Like, I know from like the UX research thing, there's always the issue of the CEO just talked to their mom that night and their mom says that should be like this. So that's the evidence I need. Well, now it's instead of their mom, it's like this AI model trained on all of this can give this information. So my worry in your sort of example, Dennis, is that if there is sort of this instant access to all of this information and all of this data that can confirm these empowered decision makers to make those decisions, the 30 who are screaming sort of underneath, like everything is wrong, will just be more ignored in this situation. And I think that's the thing that we'll have to, it will come with just more research maturity and more AI in research maturity, sort of understanding accuracy where these things fail. And that's what I think a lot of organizations are going to have to get around on the adoption curve is.
And I agree with you. Yeah. So my question really comes, how will you, like I could ask ChatGPT, I'm going to get my driveway paved. What's the best? So they can look at, hey, there was 10,000 requests. So here's what they all had in common. When you're looking at an individual, I agree. You can say they're happy, they're not happy. Here's their main issue. I could work with Martha and she say, hey, we got to improve that. But how will AI weight that? And yes, you could say, well, now we'll go to the human being. But then all of a sudden, if you're looking at B2B models, it's like, well, those 30 in that company are not as important as the 30 in this other company, the same positions, so it's like, okay, so you can't tell the AI, give a little less weighting. You're going to take it all in, you get a human, and it's still going to be, God, I don't know how you put that together. I think,
Dennis, you're making a really good point about the human in the loop and when the human is driving the bus. Don't let the AI drive the bus, right? An example would be when you're doing qualitative research and you mentioned the very different personas or, different customers, you don't want to skew your insights to by just a few of your people. And it requires a lot of judgment to make sure you don't jump to conclusions based on a portion of your sample, and it requires the expertise and judgment for how to do that. I think as an example here, if you were to use AI to say, let's test how people respond to a new mobile app or a new mobile workflow experience that people are gonna use out in the field, like, B2B person using a new tool out in the field, and you want to know who, if you just gave it AI and say, take a look at this, and you didn't tell it through the eyes of which persona, you're going to get very imprecise feedback. But if you say, now let's do it through just the eyes of this persona, now let's test it through the eyes of this persona, that's garbage in, garbage out, unless you know who those personas are and you have some insights around the journey and where in the journey you're testing and the context. Without the context, without the personas, it's very limited in its ability to make a, it's making, you're letting the AI make assumptions about who your personas are, and it's generalizing, and it could, it'll be right on average and wrong all the time. So I think it's real, it's useful directionally to let the AI look at something and infer the personas. But like actually what you really want to do is build them and load them. It's like a better prompt. And if you don't have the right insights and research up front, that is garbage in, garbage out.
Jillian,
I'll
did
say
you
one last
have
thing. Yes. That like Dennis, exactly what you're talking about. You're talking about a simulated signal that the AI is giving you as absolute truth. And that's kind of when you prioritize the wrong ideas, stakeholder needs get misinterpreted, and then that undermines long-term customer trust. And I think as everyone was saying that AI is the directional tool. And you are the context, the oversight, and the critical thinking that is the most important part of the machine.
I mean, I think in plain English, it's the idea of weighting that not all factors of the experience are equally important really requires general intelligence, as far as we know. Other questions, reflections on how you're thinking about using AI or rejecting AI at your organization? Because I'm always happy to jump into more questions. I'm really interested.
I'm wondering, does anyone have any unhinged questions about AI?
What would an unhinged question about AI be, Julian?
Oh, I don't know. It's trending right now. Like, what's the way that you think it could be used, but you haven't tried yet, or that you wish it was used, and how do we make that happen?
Yeah, the problem, at least in the engineering world, the robots and whatnot, we'd like to get to a humanoid robot, and we all saw iRobot or whatever, Terminator. You could say, yep, this will go off the totally wrong direction if we don't control it. But right now we're working with NVIDIA, and it's just unbelievable, what a robot can do with AI. So we're excited in the automation space, but all the users are scared to death. What does this mean? Will my process now be owned by the AI and not by me? So not exactly what you are saying, the unhinged, but from a manufacturer who owns the process, they're looking at it. It could be way better, but they're afraid to let it out of the box because the AI model wants to mash them all together to say, no, the 5 billion inputs that I have says you're doing it wrong. And then it's all of a sudden everyone is exactly the same process-wise in a factory, and I don't own the IP. So it's a scary model on our side. On this side, I love it. I'm waiting for the medical side because I think the medical side will be unbelievable for us, and the classroom. I'm hoping that it could really set off, the world with
I
training and
think it
teaching.
already has with the classroom that it's really that each student can have their own personal AI to tutor them on algebra or whatever the topic of the day is. I think it's already proven its impact and just how much better that educational model is than one teacher in front of 35 students trying to address everybody at sort of generically.
But everything you're saying, Martha, and everyone on your panel just proves to me that I still need to have an expert like Martha in the CXPA space
Thank
that
you.
I can listen to. We could bounce. I can hear all the information. You could tell me what's going on, and then I come back and say, yeah, that's not what we're seeing, and here's why. And then I know then you guys could tweak your models and how it works. So I love this, but I won't go forward without a CXPA expert kind of by my side.
And I did not pre-prompt Dennis to say any of that, promise. Let's do some final reflections. We only have about 4 minutes.
Hey, Martha, I
Yeah.
did have a question,
Okay, sure.
if I can ask that to the group. So really just kind of doing, I mean, let's go to the very basics really on all of this. So I work in the healthcare industry, so we've really been trying to, I mean, get policies around this, right? Because we need to protect client information, customer information, patient information, all of that as well. So really trying to get, how do we want to implement AI within all of this, within the safe parameters that we need it to be with them? So literally, we've just opened up Copilot within a closed instance for us to be able to use that internally. There is, some talks of trying to implement other things, in the future, but just wondering, anyone who is in this space is using this, what are you using? Like, what's even the platform just besides just open ChatGPT? I mean, what are you doing with it? What are you using? Is it, a paid program, or have you found something that's, a cheap alternative, to adding on to other services that you have?
Yeah, I know that there exist a lot of bespoke companies that are creating housed, safe, secure models that you can operate within, like Copilot. But that this also brings in any other data that you want to have as an input into it as well. I'm blanking on the couple names right now, but this is an emerging space, and I think that like it is still ripe for competition and creation. It's coming though. It's coming. Yeah.
So cute.
Hey, Jack, did you have any particular tools that you wanted to throw out to
Yeah,
Barbara?
I mean, I think Notebook LM is like an interesting use case. So that's something where you can sort of provide your own data sources and then provide it, then ask it to do things with that data. So you are controlling sort of what data it is referencing and calling upon. So you can be careful in that instance, which is pretty helpful. I honestly have not tested the others, and I'm not going to speak to things that I haven't tested.
I could
Understood.
make a comment as
There's
well.
Yeah. Go ahead.
There's
Yes.
like, oh, please
Go
go
ahead.
ahead.
All right. So I was saying here is, my name is Chris Franco. I'm from Yaskawa. We're getting ready to launch a new knowledge-based system that has AI capabilities built in, and it's our own fully in-house behind our firewall LLM with all of our own data and some content that we added externally within that, but stays within our walls. And we're using it to help customers with support cases where they can have a general conversation about problems they're having, and the AI is summarizing all of the information from the knowledge base and sharing links to where within the knowledge base that information came from, so that can help the user get to the solutions.
Nice. I like it. I haven't used Notebook enough because I'm sure Google is just doing such amazing things. I just personally find myself trapped in the world of ChatGPT. I've experimented with Claude and not found it terribly great in spite of all of its great reviews. We are at 5 minutes to the hour. I feel like there's so much we could be talking about with regard to building cultures around experimentation, with regard to, really diving more into replicability and validation, which are always, important topics when it comes to research. But what I do hope is that we've sort of opened up sort of a range of thinking, and introduced you to three interesting thinkers on this topic of AI and research. And I would say stay in touch. I'm sure they're, as I am, available on LinkedIn to answer any question. And do, if you want to stay on and have some ideas about our next topic, which will be June, I think it'll be June or mid-July. Please do, or shoot me an email about that. Thank you guys, for speaking today. And with that, we're going to close her up, but do stay on if you have some thoughts about speakers, or certainly my three speakers, stay on just for a couple minutes so we can talk about what's next. Thanks, everybody. Bye for now.
Realities.